Empire itself is not a liberator. It creates means, not goals.
The tools for solving the problems are knowledge and understanding. Know the facts, but see how they fit in the big picture.
Hello and welcome everyone joining us on another exciting episode of the Labuensor podcast, where we are looking over the shoulders of the giants in science. My name is Bernd, and this season we are focusing on science communication, a very important but sometimes overlooked part of research.
My name is Marta, and I'm very excited to be here.
Yes, also hello from my side. My name is Christoph, and today we are very happy to welcome Rosa Arias. Rosa studied chemical engineering and obtained a master in energy from the Heriot Watt University, Edinburgh. After her education, she then engaged herself in citizen science projects. And for more than 15 years, she has worked in that field. And during that time, she has coordinated various projects, among others, the DNOSIS and the NEWS ERA projects. And she will also coordinate the future European Competence Center in Science Communication. Rosa is the CEO and founder of Science for Change. The mission and workflow of Science for Change and which projects they are engaged in will be the main focus of today's episode. So once again, welcome Rosa. We're very happy to have you here today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very glad to be here with you.
Yes, and let me start the podcast with actually the beginning of your career, which, if I'm not wrong, was the Odor Collect app, actually quite a successful project. Could you share a little bit what the Odor Collect app actually is and how it started?
Yes, I can explain you a little bit the story of my life, maybe. Because I'm a chemical engineer, as you mentioned, and after studying my degree, I went into work to measure odors, like odor pollution from industrial side, so smells that affect our quality of life every day, coming from landfills or wastewater treatment stations, things like that. And smells are very difficult to measure, as you can imagine, because you cannot see them. They are volatile compounds, molecules that you need to capture and take to the lab and see what is in there. But our sense of smell is really powerful, and chemical sensor cannot mimic our perception. So we always need a human nose to measure the smells that we are perceiving. In the case of traditional methodologies to measure this type of pollution, which is in fact a type of air pollution, you always measure the smells from the point of view of the emitter, not the receptor. And then you measure in the chimneys, in the basins that are producing the smells, and you use a mathematical model to calculate, to estimate the emission, the impact area around the activities, but doesn't give you real time or the real perception of the citizens that are affected by this type of pollution. And also it has a lot of uncertainty. So I thought, why cannot we change like the paradigm? And instead of measuring from the emitter, we measure from the receptor. We all have our nose, which is in fact the best sensor to measure the odors. So it could be very simple if we had a tool like Odor Collect, the app that I created, just to collect the smells that we are perceiving in our daily lives, wherever we are, at any point, at any time. You just take your phone, you smell with your nose, you identify the type of smell, and then you add a new point on the map. And with that, we have real-time data for the first time that is accurate to our perception because it's provided by citizens. And from there, you can understand the origin of that smell and you can try to minimize it to reduce the impact on the population.
Thank you very much. I actually tried out the Odor Collect app. It's quite fun. We will link it definitely in our show notes. You can watch on an interactive map where there are odors in your area, and I detected some quite near to my place.
Great.
Was this project actually the starting point? Was this the moment when you realized that you want to continue in citizen science projects?
Yes. In fact, when I tried to create this new methodology, I didn't know it was called citizen science. In fact, I started to read and research, and I said, okay, I'm creating a citizen science project, but I was not aware that this is something that exists. What I did when I had the idea of the app is to try to find a way of developing the project, but it's quite difficult for a person without the support of an institution behind or, you know, someone. You cannot, you know, submit a European project, for example, proposal, if you are just Rosa, you know. So I was trying to see how I could manage to present my idea without something behind. So I started a collaboration with a foundation here in Spain. I'm based in Barcelona, by the way, and they were experts in citizen science. So I presented them the idea, and yeah, they liked it very much. And we tried to find a funding source to develop it. And basically, we won a small contest from the JRC in 2016, more or less. But it gave us just a very small amount of money just to create a first version of Android. But we couldn't test it or validate it or anything. So we just had a tool, but with no data on it because we have no citizens engaged or anything like that. And then I wrote a project, a European project, which was the Dinosis project that you mentioned. This was a big one with a 3 million euro budget and, you know, 14 partners, 9 countries. It was not talking about citizen science, not talking about others, but I just wrote my idea there and tried to, you know, bet for it. And yeah, we were very lucky. And in fact, it won the goal. And I submitted it under the name of Ibercivis, which was the foundation that helped me to present the project, but with the commitment that I would create my own company, Science for Change, to exploit the results of the project. So this is how I managed to push for my idea and yeah, create the company that now I have the freedom just to present any project that I like or any new ideas that we can have.
Interesting journey that you went through there. As we already mentioned it quite a few times, one of the central topics will be citizen science. Therefore, it is probably good if you could briefly explain to our listeners what this term actually means.
Yes, it's something that you can use to measure or to generate new knowledge with citizens in any field of research. In the case of smells, it's very simple because we already have the sensor incorporated in ourselves. It's the nose, the human nose. In some other cases, imagine that you want to measure, I don't know, greenhouse gases or particles or things. Then usually you need to use like a low-cost sensors, which are not so precise as other type of sensors. And some of the times you can gather with people qualitative data, quantitative data, or pictures. It's always involving the citizens, any age, any previous knowledge or whatever, in the research process to generate data together with them. Data that usually you cannot manage to get without them. So maybe this data is not so precise, but you can increase very much the granularity of your data set or the geographical spread, or you can, I don't know, collaborate, I don't know. For example, in biodiversity, there is a paper from 2017 that it says that most of the data on the biodiversity field come from citizen science projects. And there are big projects that monitor the migration of birds from the South America to North America. And all of it is because of the citizen observations. The potential is huge. You can also use it for to tackle more the social sciences and map cultural heritage, graffitis in the city, wherever you want with the help of citizens, which in fact have the local knowledge of the issue that you are measuring. So they are generating new knowledge together with the scientific teams.
I imagine that the benefits are then that you get to interact with a lot of people. Everyone brings their own knowledge, their own sensors, as you said, in the Odors app. But this seems like it would be the difficulties as well, interacting with so many people, different actors, and engaging everyone.
Yes, it's not easy. And you need to, in fact, involve them, the different stakeholders. We work, of course, we always work with citizens, but we also work with public authorities, for example, if we want to have policy impact, or with industries, or with other scientists, because we need to work very interdisciplinary to do all this type of research. So it's challenging. You need to create like a specific engagement strategy for each one of the stakeholders, not only the citizens you are targeting, but also the other ones. Find their motivations, the barriers to engagement, find strategies. And for this, of course, science communication is key. And also participation through different workshops, events, etc. And you can engage them not only in the data collection phase, but also at the very beginning of the process. So you can even co-create with them the research question, or then involve them in analyzing the data so that they can help you interpret the data in their daily lives. And also, for example, to create with them new forms of science communication, like artistic visualizations of the data together with the citizens and other stakeholders. I mean, you can do whatever you want. It's just a matter of finding the motivation and the right strategies to engage with them.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating how Science for Change in the end brings everyone together, because at the heart of Science for Change, your company that you founded after the Odor Collect, you also have citizen science, right? So it's a matter of bringing everyone together. We're actually curious because, like you said, at Science for Change, you have four different stakeholders. So you have citizens, academia, but then also public authorities and also public policies. And I think it's essential to have all these players all together having a discussion and seeing what's the best solution. But so is it difficult to bring them all together? Because I think that's the biggest challenge you have.
Yes. In fact, you need to decide not only the engagement strategy for the specific stakeholder group, but also an overall strategy, like, for example, who you want to approach first. Because you need to gain the trust of the different stakeholders. And if you go first, for example, to the citizens or to the public sector or to the industry or to a scientist, then the second group that you will say, oh, I'm working with this group on this. So they will think that you are on their team, not, you know, on the previous group team. So it's not like that. You need to explain in a transparent manner the objectives of the problem, what you want to put all these actors to work together on an issue, and build a kind of shared agenda for everybody so that they feel comfortable. They know what are the purpose, the results, etc., why they need to contribute, what will be the final goal, and the commitments from each one of the stakeholders, and gain their trust. And this is a time-consuming process, you know. You need to be there. And once you have all these pieces, we could be like the glue for the pieces, then you start executing the project, like start generating data, etc. But then first you need to create like the engagement for all the stakeholders, which is quite challenging in a sense, and also to maintain it over time, because you cannot overpromise. You need to be very ethical, you know. You cannot say, oh, you will please participate in my smell project and then the problem will disappear. This is not true. It doesn't depend on me. I can only collect data to objectivize the issue and just give this data to the industries or the activities so that they can act upon this with the evidence generated, but I cannot solve the issue. So you need to build the trust, being very transparent and honest, so that everybody feels also good and comply with your promises with time. If not, you will lose the engagement.
So from the four players you are working with, the public, academia, policymakers, and industries, which one do you find the most challenging to engage with?
Yes, I mean, it's totally dependent on the context. Sometimes, for example, in Genosis, we did these case studies in 10 different places in 9 countries. So we have cases in Barcelona, for example, or in Chile, in Uganda, in Germany, in London. In some of the cases, the industry was really committed. They thought that this could be very useful for them with this new data set that we were providing. In some others, it was the public authority that was reluctant. It was like, why? I mean, you are afraid, or maybe they said, oh, we don't want to be on the map as a city that smells. Okay, I understand that, but it's not that. We are just objectifying the situation and so on. Or some other times the citizens were really reluctant because they were very, very tired of this situation. Maybe they have been suffering from other pollution for many years, even decades. So it was like, oh, who are you now? And what do you want? It depends on the situation. And you always need to find this motivation, talk a lot, and put all the people, sit them on the same table. And then then they start understanding little by little. And then the project can go.
Is it common that you have different ideas of the output of such a project? Like the expectations of each individual group are actually higher than what you actually achieve or what you think?
Yes, for sure. Because as I was mentioning, the final result does not depend on us. So, for example, if you want to take corrective measures, it's on the industries. Or if you want the public authorities to do something or to push for a new regulation or something, it's on them. So sometimes they overpromise. We do not, but sometimes they do. And for example, in Genosis here, in the case of Barcelona, the public authority promised us to give access to all the industrial operational data that we want to correlate with the citizen observation. And of course, we were telling the citizens, oh, this will be very nice because we will produce another management plan based on your observations, blah, blah, blah. And it never happened. It's true that the pandemic came and this, slowed things down and then maybe we lost the momentum, but we never got the data. So at the end, the citizens were really disappointed because of that, but it was not our fault in a sense. No? So yeah, it's a question of managing expectations.
I guess all of this enters into doing science communication, right? Because you have to, like you said, you have to convince people that what you're doing is important no matter what you're doing. So how do you think making good science communication looks like? I know this is a very difficult question and very general.
No, for me, we like to co-create everything. That's true, with all these different stakeholders. And many times we do workshops, for example, to co-create communication messages that are more effective to target the right stakeholders and so on. But this is quite specific. The thing is that when you are trying to engage the public in science or any other stakeholder, you really need to talk their language, basically. So you cannot expect to be understood like reading a paper, you cannot go with that discourse, no? Yes, my science is the best, I'm the best scientist, blah, 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 these are my results, and then you expect that the other part understands what you are saying, or maybe you expect that you have the same objectives as this other part, being it a citizen or a policymaker or whoever, or even a fellow scientist. The objectives are never the same, so you need to put yourself on the shoes of the stakeholder that you want to reach. And use the language that they understand. Take into account the timings where they need to receive the information, the channels that they use, all these type of things. If not, it will be impossible. So you cannot expect that you write a paper and then that's it. No, you reach everybody, everybody understands you, it's super nice, and your research is communicated. No, you really need to use the channels, the language, and everything else from the other people that you want to reach.
I mean, I think one of the biggest difficulties that you have in science communication, like you said, is setting the language according to the public you have in front, whether it's a citizen, a public maker, or a public policy maker, sorry.
Yeah. And in fact, this was my own learning by doing, because when I started the Dinosis project, it was like this. I am a chemical engineer, so I was talking to the citizens like, oh, this is the incinerator, you see this chimney, blah, 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 the process, it's producing these molecules that smell, so no. And then I started to work with an anthropologist, which was executing the project with me. We call ourselves like the mixed couple, the engineer and the anthropologist. And she was translating the language so that people understand what I was talking about. For me, it was super clear what I was talking about, but nobody understood me very well, you know. So she helped me with this translation. And that's why we started working on the New Syrup project, which was like a kind of follow-up of Dinosis, because we really found that we had that need on communicating better with all the stakeholders so that we can engage them. If not, it's impossible. And in fact, in that project, we managed to engage 39 citizen science projects from Portugal, Spain, and Italy that were working in many different fields of research. And all of them have the same need, which was science communication. Many times these type of projects are maybe promoted by one researcher, one individual researcher, that maybe it has a communication team behind, maybe not, but you need to be the PI, you need to communicate, you need to do the engagement, you maybe need an IT tool to collect the data, then you need to analyze the data, validate the data, find the finding, do the work, and everything else. And science communication is like the least of your problems, but it's essential for you. And we found that we created this community of 39 projects where we were working together for 3 years. And in fact, we produced a lot of useful results. I invite you to take a look at the New Syrup project website, where you will find all the blueprints for communicating better with scientists, citizens, policymakers, industries, etc., and the media as well, because it's a different world as well. The projects were really relief that to see that they were not the only ones that had that need, and that everybody else was in the same situation. I mean, it's a science in itself. Citizen science is a science in itself. Science communication is a science in itself. So it's not so easy. You need to learn, and you need probably help to do the right communication and reach your stakeholders. It's a big challenge as well.
You just said it, that you need to learn. Do you think we need some kind of formal training, like a formal science communication course, or generally, how would you say can we pass on this knowledge?
Yeah, for me, it's not such a matter of formal, informal, non-formal. But for example, in our case, we have always used co-creation workshops and very participatory webinars or workshops or activities to learn, because we have been learning by doing, as I mentioned before. And I think it's something that works very well. With your own project, for example, in New Zealand, we also organize citizen science communication labs that we, as we call them. And we were working together with citizen science projects and the stakeholder groups. And we were having experts in science communication or journalists, for example, and we produce journalistic pieces with the data generated with the citizens and many different things. But they were very practical approach. Because you really have a need, which is your project, you want to communicate. So we were co-creating these communication plans, prioritizing them, because you cannot do everything at once. Depending also on your objectives, you may need to do something different, not social networks. For example, projects that wanted to have policy impact, they need to create events or webinars or plan meetings with the stakeholders. I don't know. There are many different types of strategies that you can use. So it's not a matter of someone telling you, these are the principles of science communication. that you can do blah, blah, blah. You can create a Twitter account or whatever. Depends, because it depends on your project objectives, also on your resources and your priorities. So for me, it's nicer if you can have an expert that you can discuss directly with, or show the results you have, your needs, etc., and you can build together a strategy or something you will learn in the process for sure, and at the end you will get what you need to communicate better.
Well, it seems like science communication is a little bit like science itself, where you have best practices,
yeah,
but you always have to adapt it on your research topic, and it's never one size fits all.
Exactly, yeah.
But we have talked now a lot about your past projects. Could you provide us also with an overview of your ongoing projects, or the projects for Science for a Change in general?
Yes. In fact, talking about science communication and training, we are coordinating now the project that is called Coalesce, which is bringing together like the 8 previous European projects that were working on science communication. One of them was New Zealand that I already explained you, but there were other 7 projects funded. So we joined forces and we are creating the European Competence Center for Science Communication. And this is quite a big project. It started last April, so almost 1 year ago, and will last for 3 more years. And we are building a virtual platform that is consolidating and bringing together all the knowledge generated by all the European projects, but also we are creating a network of national ambassadors and hubs that will bring also more knowledge on science communication. We are building a mechanism to act on times of crisis, like, for example, the pandemics, how to communicate better, or in the case of climate change, for example, which has a different timing, but it's also kind of an emergency also for citizens, and you need to communicate this uncertainty also very well. So we are compiling all this knowledge, and it will be available soon. And we are also organizing a lot of participatory activities where you can all participate. And I encourage you to follow the project if you are interested in this topic. And we have also several specific scientific fields where we will be doing pilots and also working with libraries, also working and bringing science towards places where it usually is not, like, for example, music festivals and things like that. Because the overall objective, no, it's to bring science closer to society. We need to go where society is in any imaginable way. So we will be testing all these new forms of communicating science as well. So yeah, this is a very nice project.
Maybe let's stay a second at the Coalescence project. So is it more like a virtual university where science communicators go and research or teach? Or do you want to provide guidelines or best practice rules? Or
yes, there will be a lot of guidelines, best practices, documents, results from the other projects and for more projects, etc., available. But we will also build an academy, the Coalesce Virtual Academy, where we will offer trainings. And we also will create a matchmaking tool to get together journalists and scientists, because this is also a challenge for us when we want to reach the media that can increase very much the impact of our projects. Usually we don't know how to get to the media or to the right media, or how to get our research published in there. So we will try also to facilitate this by creating this matchmaking tool, and also try to influence policy at the European level and national levels to increase the support to the practice, to science communication, specifically because of this huge need of training that we, the research community, have.
But so who are the players in this Science for Change?
Well, we are a consortium of 13 partners, We are the co-coordinators together with the Erasmus University in Rotterdam, and we put together the coordinators of the past science communication projects that were funded by the European Commission as well, plus some other partners. In total, we are 13. But we are creating these networks of national and regional science communication hubs, involving a lot of networks, working on the specific topics that we selected, which are climate change, health, oceans and water, and artificial intelligence, to understand these mechanisms on how to communicate quickly in times of crisis, but many other networks. So we are trying to build a huge amount of people together, as we like to do, to consolidate all the knowledge, create the academy, do the trainings, and also advocate for more support towards science communication.
It sounds challenging, but very, very interesting and also fulfilling, I would say. When the project will be finished, it will be amazing, I think, to see the end result.
Maybe it's asked too much, but apart from the citizen science projects you're very actively engaged in, what other means could you imagine to improve scientific literacy?
It happens by virtue. For example, in citizen science, you are generating new knowledge. You get really involved in the research. So you are learning all the time in many different aspects, not only about the scientific domain in which you are contributing, but for example, if you are using an app, you can also address the digital gap between different types of citizens, or also you can address the gap of women in science. You can raise awareness, you can push for behavioral changes, because people, when they measure something, they realize, for example, our own contribution to greenhouse gases emissions. Maybe you are not aware of your decisions, the implications of your decisions. If you take the car, if you go by bike, if you walk, if you turn on the lights, you know, all these things, when you measure them, you are really conscious of your impact, no? Also on the planet or on society. So this is very interesting. And in the case of science communication, it's also very funny, because citizens engaged in citizen science projects, they become science communicators themselves, because they get so excited and they have their own results. They feel that the research is a bit of their own. So they communicate it to their neighbors, to their family. They use their own channels, their social networks to talk about the project. So it's like a kind of a snowball effect, but because they learn in the way as well. No?
And they have already automatically the language of the peers that they're addressing. They are also neighbors addressing other neighbors. Yeah,
exactly. They can be much better understood than myself, for example. And that's why we like to organize these co-creation workshops, to create messages that are understandable with them. Because if they produce a message, it will be for sure understood by their neighbors. So this is a very powerful one.
So maybe you mentioned it a little bit before. So just to close, let's say, I guess women in science, it's a topic that is very important for you.
Yes, for us, it's very, very important to attract more girls and women into science. And yes, my team, we are more or less 25 people, and from them, 80% are women, or something like that. So only the developers, the IT developers, are the men that we have on the team, because it's so super difficult to find women that are developing because of the gap, a career path that we take. So for us, it's very, very important. And we try to act as reference for the girls and women that we engage in our projects, to bring them closer to science, just demonstrating with our own example that a scientist is not a white man with a coat, a white coat, but can be anyone. can be, and you can have all type of scientists. You don't need to be Einstein or Marie Curie, you know, to be the best science in the world. Yeah, one of the main issues for this bridge, this gap on science is the lack of references. So for me, it's very important that we have this women team so that we can go everywhere and demonstrate that everybody can be a scientist, and more girls and women can feel identified and maybe change their decisions, or, you know, be encouraged to follow a scientific path. If they want, they cannot think that it is not for themselves.
When I was choosing my career path, I would have loved to have someone like you as a reference.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you a lot, Roz. It was a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, it was very, very fun. I hope that it has been also interesting for the listeners. And just contact us if you want more information or anything. We are always open to collaborate or anything like that. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you also very much from my side. Could you tell us briefly what's the best way to reach out? Do you have Facebook, Instagram?
Yes, we have for Science for Change. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, well, X. Facebook we have, but it's not very active. But also Odor Collect has its own networks if you want to know more about the smells. And by the way, we will have the small brother of Odor Collect coming soon, which will be called Sound Collect. And we will be working on quiet areas to identify places in urban environments where you can go and rest. And we will link that with also nice smells, because not everything is odor pollution. So you can also enjoy the smell of the flowers or nature or wet floor or whatever. Just keep an eye on it and participate, because we want everybody to participate. The projects, I forgot to mention that you can map everywhere in the world. We even have observations in Antarctica. So just feel free to download the app and help us.
Well, we have already talked a lot about bad smells, but do you also have a favorite smell?
Yes, because, you know, smells that can, the sense of smell is the most powerful of our senses. And it's like kind of magic, because it's connected directly with your memories and can make you travel in time and space. When you smell something from when you were a child, for example, or maybe it can remind you of your grandma or something like that. So my favorite smells are the ones that are connected with Galicia, which is not where I live, but it's a rural area in Spain, the north of Portugal, which is it's very in the nature. So you always have the smell of the chimney, you know, of the trees, of the flowers, like a mixture of things. And when I smell that, I immediately travel to this place. And it's very, very nice. This feeling is like unique. It's the only way that we can travel in time, I think.
Great. And I would say to all of our listeners, now it's time for you to get out and map the smells of your home or of the regions you like on the Odor Collect app, because you also can add positive smells there. So that is great. And yeah, I think it was a wonderful interview. Today we learned a lot about citizen science. So Rosa told us that the key to do citizen science is finding the motivation and devise a strategy to engage each individual players. And science communication, of course, is the underlying principle, is very important, and you have to speak a common language. I think we cannot emphasize this enough. Thank you very much, Rosa, for today. It was a pleasure. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you also from my side. And if you want to learn more about science communication or other fascinating topics related to science, you can find us still on Twitter at LaborInsOr, but most importantly on our website that will be linked with a lot of other links to Rosa's website in the show notes.